Blog Talk Radio. Eastern family, we've got breaking news.
Breaking news number one. Life Safety Foundation calls for sweeping changes to pilot training by Rob Mock from Flying Magazine. Despite strides in 2017, the safety problem has not been solved. The pilot training system in the United States has remained essentially unchanged for the past 50 or 60 years, with just a few notable exceptions. New technologies have added complexity to the training process, while loss of control accidents have focused everyone on how much we actually did not know about how airplanes fly. Two accidents in 2009 caught the industry's attention related to loss of control, for instance. The crash of a Continental Express Dash 8 in Buffalo, New York, and an Air France Airbus A330 over the South Atlantic convinced the FAA that the way we've been teaching stalls and stall recovery were all wrong. Companies have since sprung up to teach upset and recovery prevention, focused primarily on recognition of an impending stall, hoping the recovery techniques might never be needed. See more on EAL Radio Show, January-June 2018.
Breaking news number two. India is the country most female-friendly for pilots. This is by Russ Niles. As Women of Aviation Week began March 8th, the first female pilot license worldwide was issued on March 8th, 1910. The country with the highest ratio of female airline pilots may come as a surprise to some. India has the most female pilots per capita, as a little more than 12% of Indian airline pilots are women. Finland is neck and neck with India, but most other countries are far behind that total. In the U.S., it's 5.1%, and worldwide, just 5%. India was relatively late to the game in hiring females for the flight deck, but its airline industry is also fairly new. The first female first officer started working in 1984. You can see more on the EAL Radio Show website's newsletters.
Breaking news number three, accident reform. How it affects pilots and employee fringe benefits, by Dan White. He's a senior benefits attorney, ALPA, Retirement and Insurance Department. The Tax Cut and Jobs Act, TCJA, was signed into law by President Trump on December 22, 2017. It makes sweeping changes to the Internal Revenue Code in general and substantially modifies the taxation of employees' fringe benefits, which is expected to significantly impact pilots. Fortunately, the TCJA made only modest changes to retirement benefits. Generally, most provisions of the TCJA took effect January 1st, 2018, and apply to income earned beginning in the 2018 taxable year. Many of these changes sunset after December 31st, 2025, unless Congress passes an extension. Congress subsequently passed the Bipartisan Budget Act, BBA, which President Trump signed February 9th of 2018. This law features several tax provisions that have previously been dropped from the TCJA. You can see more of this on the EAL Radio Show website newsletters. Over to you, Chuck.
Breaking news number four. Do pilots need a college degree? By AWeb. In my recent wanderings on the online aviation world, I came across questions in a few different places. If pilots are so scarce, why do airlines still require pilot applicants to have a four-year college degree, especially since they often don't seem to care what degree it is in? Forestry, engineering, English lit, all seem to equally make the cut. Getting that degree requires a substantial investment in time, energy, and money. Wouldn't those resources be better spent on building hours and adding certificates? I asked a few professional pilots for their take on this and came up with some surprising responses. Corporate jet pilot told me that, in fact, many airlines don't expressly require a degree, though it may be listed as a preference. See more on EAL Radio Show website newsletters. Jim Hart.
Hello, Eastern family. It's great having you with us. My name is Jim Hart. Along with our other host, we want to welcome and thank you for listening, calling into the show. You have made us radio voice of Eastern Airlines. We'd love to hear your comments and share your memories with radio listeners from around the world. If you haven't called into the show, all you have to do is call 213-816-1611 and just say hi or hola, or buenos dias, como esta, bonjour, and talk with us on the air live. We can identify many countries in our Blog Talk Radio application. Isn't it great that we can keep the Eastern legacy going out, not only to the Eastern family, but to listeners from many different countries? That's what we try to do every week on the EAL Radio Show. Won't you join us by adding your voice to these broadcasts? Our thanks also to those who choose to listen by computer, using the radio icon on our homepage at www.ealradioshow.com, or perhaps by signing in at the site of our provider, Blog Talk Radio, at www.blogtalkradio.com/Captain Eddie. That's C-A-P-T, Eddie. Should you too wish to talk on our live broadcast, feel free to use in our call-in number, 213-816-1611, at 7 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Pardon me. Let me repeat the number so we can write it down for our Monday night visits. It's 213-816-1611. Our lines are always open for calls. If you choose not to participate and pardon me, and talk live with our host, we ask you to please mute your phone at our producer's board, as our producer's board does not have the capability of filtering out background noises. Now, Neil, let's get flight number 355 into the air.
minute. As the day goes by, feel yourself in it. It's a good day to up and fly away. It's so easy to do. Easton's got the right time.
Tonight's special host is Linda Fuller, narrating our show. Linda, it's all yours.
Thank you, Captain Neil. The Pitcairn Mail Wing was developed to carry mail for the U.S. Postal Service. The first flight of the Pitcairn Mail Wing was in 1927. Mail was carried in a fireproof compartment forward in the pilot's cockpit. Was this the beginning of Eastern Airlines? Well, when you go to the famous Smithsonian Institute in Washington, D.C., you will see this beautiful airplane, which was purchased by the proud employees of Eastern Airlines. It was restored and presented to the museum by company president Edward B. Rickenbacker. It is hanging so high, suspended from the museum ceiling, and both on the side of this beautiful airplane, you read the words, Eastern Airlines Transport Incorporated, U.S. Mail. So that brings us to Eastern's very first pilot, Gene Brown. Now, the word captain, which indicates a pilot status, was not used back then, not until much later in commercial aviation. And so now we will envision pilot Gene Brown, who has just landed with Pitcairn Mail Wing, and he has taxied to the hangar for fuel in Richmond, Virginia. He's right on schedule at 1:28 a.m. Next stop on his route to Atlanta is Greensboro, North Carolina, Spartanburg, South Carolina, and scheduled arrival time into Atlanta, Georgia at 5:17 a.m. Now, we will listen in as Gene Brown, and his voice will be portrayed by our own Jim Hart, has climbed out of the open cockpit. He's removed his goggles, and he's preparing to shake hands with Dick Merrill, who was a much-celebrated Eastern pilot, another air mail service pilot, who is portrayed here by none other than Eastern Captain Jim Holder. Dick Merrill has walked now from his aircraft flying the northbound trip to New York's New Brunswick Airport.
How is the weather going south, Dick? You got clear skies, except for stars and the moon, headed northbound.
Gene, you might have a little patch of fog about halfway to Greensboro. Other than that, it's pretty good all the way to Atlanta. And by the way, I saw a great checkpoint about halfway to Greensboro. A farmer cleared a very large field close to Chase, South Carolina, which seems to work on course to Greensboro. Looks good for an emergency landing if you got to put her down. I dropped in for a visit with him a few trips ago. I was just checking the field to make sure it'd be good for landing. He's a really nice guy, and he has a telephone we can use to check in with the company if we have to land there. I bet you he'd feed you and have a nice bed if need be. I got a few of those landmarks in a notebook, and one day we'll just have to have coffee and compare notes.
Thanks, Dick. I'll put it on my map. Boy, I sure can't wait till they put those beacon lights up along the airway. It'll take the guesswork out of flying. Pitcairn will be giving us all a briefing on how to navigate using them. I carry a notebook with me with landmarks, roads, railroad tracks, lakes, and cleared fields. Water towers are great. Well, I just got this. That has been fueled, loaded. Land in a few days, Dick.
In the early days of flight, there were no navigation aids to help pilots find their way. Pilots flew by looking out of their cockpit window for visual landmarks or by using automobile road maps. These visual landmarks or maps were fine for daytime, but airmail operated around the clock. Chuck, how about you telling us about these beacons Jim Brown was talking about?
Sure, Linda. In 1919, the U.S. Army Air Service, Lieutenant Donald Margaret, began using bonfires and the first artificial beacons to help with night navigation. In February 1921, an airmail pilot named Jack Knight put this to the test. With all-night flight to Chicago from North Platte, Nebraska, Knight found the way across the Black Prairie with the help of bonfires lit by the post office staff, some farmers, and the public. By July 1923, Mernon's idea of lighted airport boundaries, spotlit windsocks, and rotating beacons on towers had taken hold. The Army opened an experimental light airways between McCook Field in Dayton, Ohio, and Norton Field in Columbus, a distance of 72 miles. That's about 116 kilometers. Beginning in 1923, the post office worked to complete a transcontinental airway beacon on towers spaced 15 to 25 miles apart, each with enough brightness or candle power to be seen for 40 miles in clear weather. By June 1927, 4,121 miles of airways had lights. By 1933, 18,000 miles and 1,500 beacons were in place. Each tower had a site number painted on it for daytime identification. At night, the beacons flashed in a certain sequence so the pilots could match their location to the printed guide that they carried with them. Besides the rotating beacon, one fixed tower light pointed it to the next field and one to the previous tower, forming an aerial roadway. Officials and emergency fields were lit with green lights, while dangerous fields were marked with red. Jim?
Yeah, Chuck, thanks. Because of this effort, by the 1920s, the swashbuckling days of airmail operations had begun to pass. The lone pilot dressed in a leather flight suit who sat in an open cockpit battling the elements to deliver the mail was romantic, but very inefficient. The Postal Service began to focus on safety and reliability as well as on expanding the operations. It established minimum lighting requirements for all airmail stations of 500 watts. Revolving searchlight projecting a beam parallel to the ground to guide pilots. Another searchlight projecting into the wind to show which direction to land, and aircraft wind tip flares for forced landings. It also prescribed that all landing fields should be at least 2,000 feet by 1,500 feet. That's a big rectangle to allow plenty of room for landings. And as a final safety device, the requirement for a searchlight to be mounted on airmail airplanes, that was appended to the post office set of requirements. The use of lighted airways allowed pilots to fly at night, but they still needed to maintain visual contact with the ground. A really useful air system required two-way voice communications and the ability to find out about change in weather conditions while in flight. But in 1926, pilots could only receive weather information and details about other planes in the air was just before takeoff. If conditions changed while flying, there was no way to warn them. There's just no way of the pilot communicate with the ground. He was on his own. It was pretty much the way Gene Brown and Dick Merle briefed each other in our opening skit. The Bureau of Standards began to work on two-way technology in December of 1926 at its experimental station in College Park, Maryland. By the next April, it had an experimental ground-to-air radio telephone system operating that could communicate up to 50 miles. Soon after, a transmitter installed at Bellefonte, Pennsylvania, which was on the Transcontinental Airway, successfully communicated with an airmail plane 150 miles away. That was big stuff back then. In October of 1928, the aeronautics branch installed a group of new radio stations to complement the 17 it had inherited from the Postal Service. It also began sending voice information to help pilots navigate, first by radio telegraphy, I'm not sure what that is, and then by teletype writer. By the end of 1934, there were 68 communication stations, and many pilots could request navigation help by two-way radio. Then in 1928, the Bureau of Standards also developed a radio navigational beacon system, and in 1929, the aeronautics branch standardized a four-course radio range, whereby pilots listen to audio signals to determine if they were on course. The aeronautics branch stepped up installation of four-course radio ranges, and all this technology became standard for civil air navigation through World War II. In September 1929, Army Lieutenant James H. Doolittle became the first pilot to use only aircraft instrument guidance to take off, fly a set course, and land. He used the four-course radio range and radio marker and beacons to indicate his distance from the runway. An altimeter displayed his altitude, and directional gyroscope with artificial horizon helped him control his aircraft's orientation, called attitude, without seeing the ground. These technologies became the basis for many future developments in navigation.
Wow. Things were really moving along. Can you imagine a pilot sitting in an open cockpit airplane at night in rain or snow, going from point A to point B, C, D, E, F, and even further? Many of these pioneers, I'm sad to say, would lose their lives under these conditions. Dorothy, what followed these early developments?
Linda, you wonder why on earth would anyone fly without any means of assisted navigation is beyond me. That's why I guess it was called flying by the seat of your pants. The aeronautics branch began formal flight inspection of airway navigation aids in 1932. Six pilots were each responsible for about 3,500 miles. That's 5,633 kilometers of federal highway. As a note, I'd like to insert here that I also read a variety of aircraft were initially assigned to the patrol pilots. The early patrol fleet apparently consisted of five Blanca pacemakers, a Curtiss-Wright sedan 15, several Stearman, three C3Bs, and three Stinson SM8As patrol work that continued in a limited fashion through the balance of the 1930s, constrained primarily by Depression-era budgets, despite the mushroom air transport system and proliferation of radio navigation aids. The early flight inspection fleet was nonetheless slowly supplanted by newer equipment, such as the Stinson SR-8B with an electrical system to handle acquired radio equipment. Through 1935, the antennas for transmitting and receiving radio range beacons were improved and more instrument navigation tests conducted. September 1935 marked the first simultaneous transmission by radio telephone of voice and weather information and radio beacon signals for navigation. And by the end of 1938, six stations were complete and 159 were in progress. In May 1941, the Civil Aeronautics Administration, CAA, opened its first ultra-high-frequency radio, UHF, range system for scheduled airline navigation, eventually expanding use of such equipment to 35,000 miles. That's 56,327 kilometers of federal highways. In 1944, with wartime advances in radio, the CAA began testing a static-free, very high-frequency VHF and an omnidirectional radio range, that's a VOR, that allowed pilots to navigate by watching a dial on their instrument panel rather than by listening to the radio signal. By the middle of the 1952, 45,000 miles of VHF and VOR airways, referred to as Victor Airways, supplemented the 70,000 miles of federally maintained low-frequency airways. The CAA began to shut down the low- and medium-frequency four-course radio ranges. In 1961, the FAA began using distance-measuring equipment on its entire system. This equipment allowed aircraft to determine the distance from known checkpoints in order to confirm their position. The first Doppler radar version of the VOR system made it more accurate for longer distances.
That's right, Dorothy. The FAA participated with the National Aeronautics and Space Administration in the first public demonstration of a new system in March 1967 that would use orbiting satellites to transmit navigation data from aircraft to ground stations. This test would follow by further development of aircraft antennas to send and receive satellite messages. In October 1969, 16 area navigation routes were developed. Previously, pilots had flown directly toward or away from ground-based radio nav aids. Those were VOR or VORTEX. This aid transmitted a course along invisible lines called radials. With the area navigation, pilots could fly any pre-selected flight path roughly within the boundaries of that local system, while an onboard computer tracked and reported the aircraft's position. Courses could be established along the shortest path within these route segments. By the end of 1973, nearly 156 high-altitude navigation routes and segments were available. The last airway light beacon system began in 1920s, was shut down in 1973. By the middle of 1982, the first of 950 new radio nav aids equipped with solid-state construction and advanced features was installed. Navigation aids, the computer supporting the system, and cockpit displays and instruments to send and receive navigation data all improved steadily throughout the 1980s.
Jim Hart, air navigation advanced to the point that Eastern Airlines flight crews were no longer flying the latest and most advanced aircraft systems. What took place after Eastern was no longer flying the airways?
Let me see if I can answer that, Linda. In October 1994, the FAA requested a government/industry study of the free flight concept, which would allow pilots to choose the most efficient routes without having to fly the prescribed routes that connect the navigation aids. Further development of free flight, including flight tests, continued in 1998. The FAA and its industry partners began limited application of some of the capabilities associated with that concept. Additional navigation technologies are in partial use or development, including the global positioning system, both to locate and help control aircraft by satellite. Pardon me. The future navigation system for remote and oceanic flights and the communication, navigation, and surveillance for air traffic management system. These technologies, combined with the need for point-to-point navigation and for higher quality voice and data communication with the need for air traffic control, the safe separation of aircraft from hazards, and for other aircraft. Pardon me. As we have heard, the first navigational highways in the sky were radio beams transmitted by ground stations. Today, most navigation is done with a global positioning system called a GPS. Certainly the GPS, which uses satellites to give the pilot a fix on where he or she is located in relation to the world around him.
is a major recent breakthrough in navigation and is hard to imagine today flying without it. However, most general aviation aircraft today still use the VHF. Mid-directional radio range, VOR, equipment is a primary or backup navigation aid. They still use the ILS system developed many years ago. Most all planes have the basic distance measuring equipment. It's called DME and transponder to identify the aircraft to air traffic controllers. Most modern airliners are now equipped with systems to make automatic landings down to zero ceiling and zero visibility. Wow, that's something. Not only does the aircraft have to be so equipped, but the airport must also meet the requirements for what is called Category 3 landings. Other navigation means throughout the years that some of our hosts are talked about are with our these they're right here. ADF, Automatic Direction Finder. Do we want to discuss that? Does anyone have a question?
Yeah, let's hold off to the end of the program where we have this. You can go ahead and tell about the different forms, and perhaps Jim and some of the other people can talk about each one of those forms of navigation. Continue on, Jim yes. Holder.
You mean Jim Hart, don't you?
I mean Jim Hart, excuse me.
Okay. Brad, the ABC is something we want to discuss. Omega, or L-1011s, were first aircraft in the Eastern Fleet to use this form of navigation. The IRS, the Inertial Reference System, our Boeing 757, was the first to use this system. I believe it's going to be Chuck. You there, Chuck?
He carried an aircraft or on the pilot's person that were designated. Dead reckoning computers was another important development, with each country air science finding a different solution. The French favored a large plotting board used in conjunction with a chart. The U.S. and Britain used a circular slide rule, subsequently integrated with a graphic plotting surface, which was placed on the reverse side. Later improved by Ensign Philip Dalton and called the Dalton computer, it was eventually became commonly known as the E-6B. During the 40s and 50s, and before electronic computer solutions were used almost exclusively, some of our pilot hosts used handheld circular slide types like the Weems, the Klein Telex, and the Gibson brand, just to name a few. Jim Holder?
Yeah, that's right, Chuck. One side was used to calculate such things as time and distance, fuel consumption, speed and miles per hour or not, and Mach, ETA, and much more. The wind triangulation was done on the reverse side to tell the heading that the pilot must fly to compensate for the wind and the aircraft speeds. Instruments which contained optics like the drift meter and sextant were adversely affected by aircraft attitude changes, and their use required the pilot to maintain a level, stable platform. Spare's early gyroscopic was imperfect, though it improved after the war in gyroscopic stabilization and provided significant improvements for a number of navigational instruments. Other instruments that saw successful development were the altimeter that it could go all the way up to 20,000 feet, the turn and bank indicator, and the artificial horizon. Harold Gatty developed a method of wind determination called a double drift maneuver in the U.S., and it was called the Windstar in Britain, to calculate winds aloft by taking drift readings on two different headings, then calculating the wind trigonometrically by plotting vectors on a graph, which he probably spun in right after that. Wind could be alternately determined by reading the drift on a single heading at two different airspeeds, but the former was preferred by the navigators, who then fed the headings to the pilot.
Well, hello? Anybody there?
We're here, Neil.
Oh, here.
Okay. So much to talk about in navigation as we come from nothing to now high tech. We can take off from an airport and program all the way to another airport, and including making the landing. And Jim, you and I flew such airplanes with Eastern Airlines, and I think probably the first most advanced one was in the L-1011, where we could make those Category 3 landings. And then along came the 757 with its all-glass cockpit. I believe it was the first glass cockpit aircraft. And with the navigation system it used was the inertial reference system, where it selected the VORs that we talked about, visual omni-range, installations around the nearest ones. It picked them up automatically and triangulated the position of the airplane. And it was very accurate. You could almost land the 757 in your mailbox, your street address. That's how accurate it was. But you could build an airport if you wanted to with that system. It was a great system. Then they had the initial, the INS, initial inertial reference system. And then we had, of course, we talked about earlier, Loran, and that's the one that gave me a fit. And we all had to qualify in the 727 when I checked out, had to qualify how to use Loran. And to this day, I still don't know how to use it. I don't know I ever even got to be captain, because that was one of the things that we had to check out. And I remember this check captain from New York. I took a trip from New York to San Juan, and I had to go completely by Loran. And it was Loran C, thank God. It was a little bit better than a Loran A and B. But the only thing I knew about the navigation using Loran was that it was called Loran, and it was either APC. And that's about, Jim, you remember the Loran days, I'm sure.
Oh, Lord, yeah. I remember, Neil, and you do too, when we first got to 727, we didn't have cockpit voice recorders. We had a two-digit transponder code. Things really came along, and the 727 was cutting edge at the time. And like you said, the first really long-range thing we got was LORAN, which stands for Long-Range Aerial Navigation. And we used it mainly, at least I did, going to Bermuda and across the Gulf, going to Mexico City. And it was a LORAN C, like you said, which was a lot easier to use. I didn't do it with A and B, but I heard they were pretty difficult. But we got into Category 3 with the 1011, and you flew the, I don't know if you, yeah, you flew the 1011, didn't you?
Yeah.
And our later 727s were Category 3A qualified, and that's right down to 1,000 RVR, that when you land, you can only see 1,000 feet in front of you if everything works right. And I'll tell you, I flew a trip one day that went down to Florida somewhere and came back to Atlanta. We had to make a Category 3 approach there. Of course, we went to the head of the line, all the other airplanes out there holding, waiting for minimums for Category 2. But we got right in and landed, you know, and it felt good, passed us on time. And then we took off and went to Denver. And that number, we didn't have to do the same thing out there. So I did two Cat 3 landings in one day. And it was 1,200 when we got there, and we had already turned to go to Strand Junction, I think it was, and they said, you just got 1,000, so we turned around and came back in and landed, and we couldn't even see to get to the gate. It was really that foggy. But we saw a lot of improvements in our years, didn't we, Neil?
Oh, yeah. And when I got on the 757, we didn't have a ceiling then. Category 2, you had to have a ceiling. I think it was 200 feet, best I recall. And a half mile visibility, and it was a Cat 2. But then along comes Cat 3 in the 757, and you only had to have an RVR. They call it an RVR, runway visual range, which is a slant visual range down the runway. And that was on the 75. It was 400 feet. And I believe it was the same on the Airbus, because I flew that and made the beautiful Category 3 approach. The airplane did. I didn't. And the airplane landed with my wife looking over my shoulder going into Los Angeles with that Pacific Sea fog that had settled in. And it became actually 00. And when we landed, touched down, she heard the wheels, and you could feel the airplane. And then you saw, the only thing you could see is one light after another, centerline light, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
That's
mm-hmm.
all you could see. But those airplanes were remarkable, and I'm sure that the electronics in the modern-day airplane now, the 787 aircraft and the Airbuses, the heads-up displays that we did not have, and now you can just look out the window and see what's projected in front of you. And heck, even Chevrolet cars now have that, right? I believe. Chuck, you would know that. They do have heads-up display.
I have one in my Corvette.
Yeah, that's right. I've seen that beautiful Corvette of yours, too. It is a pretty car. But we've come a long way. We really have in air navigation. But here's a little trivia for you. The last low-frequency range approach that we had in the United States was right here in Florida. It was the last active, and it was deactivated. I forgot what year, but it was the last one. After all the other four leg approaches were deactivated, they left one, and that was at West Palm Beach, at the West Palm Beach Airport. So,
Neil,
and
I
the
got
reason
a
I know,
range.
Huh?
Go ahead. I was going to say I got a radio range though, but you go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, the reason I know that is because I took my FAA check ride. Well, it was called CAA back in those days. It was before the FAA, and I actually got my link trainer's operator's permit. I could actually instruct in a link trainer, and I had to do that low-frequency range approach into West Palm Beach using the chart and to pass and get my rating, my rating certificate for the link trainer, which basically is now simulators instead of link trainers. They progress to the point they call simulators. But the last airway beacon, the light beacon that Dick Merrill and Gene Brown were talking about, airway beacons, there's still one active radio airway beacon. And I've told everyone on the radio show several times, does anybody remember where it is and what's the name of that? It's a national landmark.
Oh, no.
It's on the George Washington Bridge over the Hudson River, and it's called the Wiley Post Radio Beacon, Airway Beacon, the Wiley Post. It's named after Wiley Post, and it's a national landmark. And it's still activated. There was a story not too long ago, and we did kind of a little talk about that on the radio show. But they keep that thing operational.
And, very good.
Yeah. So, at any rate, that's my discussion. Anybody else have comments about navigation?
Well,
this is Jim.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Jim.
You remember?
Well, you talked about radio ranges, and I know that you had the last one in Florida, but we had the next to the last one, I bet you, in Jackson, Mississippi. And I went through pilot training at Craig Air Force Base, and, of course, that we didn't do radio ranges. Matter of fact, they had about one paragraph in the navigational manual that said, this is what it used to be. Aren't you glad you don't have to do it? And I came back, been flying nothing but jets, and they put me in to check me out on the C-119 flying boxcar, which is a whole different story. But the chief pilot, Billy Brown, he was a major, and he was a World War II B-24 pilot, had a lot of good stories. But I did all my training right there at Hawkins Field, and he said, Jim, today we're going to go out, we're going to do a radio range. And I said, a radio what? And he told me what it was amounted to, and I was so confused I could barely get by the airplane. And we got in, we took off, and it was a hot summer of 1962, and we were out there wandering around, and I have never been so lost and so confused in my life. I'm not kidding you. I did it. Of course, he couldn't hear very good, and he said, you know why I can't hear good? And I said, why is that? I've been listening to this did-dot-dot-did my whole life, you know, until he left the right of course. And we got back, and he went in and told the operations officer. I was out there in the another room, and I could hear them in there talking. Of course, I was listening to what they said about me. And he said, say Bittner, Major Bittner, he said, Bittner, do you know that they don't even teach radio ranges anymore in the Air Force pilot training? And I remember Bittner said, Billy, we are old men. Yeah, they were right. But I'll tell you, that was a word. I've never had to do another one, and I'll tell you, it's bad.
But you know, that's the closest.
Yeah, Neil, this is Jim Hart.
Jim Hart, go ahead.
Yeah, when I was hired in 1957, I was told I was to be in a management training program. And I thought, geez, this is wonderful. I come from naval aviation into commercial aviation. And so they did at Bradley Field, Hartford Springfield, they shuffled me around from the ticket counter to air cargo to operations. And I remembered in operations, after an aircraft would leave, usually they were either Martin 404s or Convair 440s, that we had to get on the teletype machine and alert the downline station that the aircraft is airborne and on the way. And I'm thinking, what a change in procedures and so on we have today. Makes you feel a little older, doesn't it?
Jim Hart, you know, I was going to tell Jim Holder, too. That's the closest thing that we have been to barnstorming. In the old days, they called it barnstorming. So I guess we had a touch of the end of the barnstorming era.
You got it. Yep.
Yeah.
I was selling airline tickets in the Flying Tiger hangar over on a milk crate because we didn't have a counter at that time. That was
yeah.
fun.
Yeah. Jim Holder, you got an added?
Yeah, I just want to talk about celestial navigation. And this goes along
yeah.
with that radio range thing. And we're at Craig Air Force Base, and we had to take a course like 2 days, half a day or something. I don't know what it was, in celestial navigation and, you know, shooting the stars and shooting the moon and all that kind of stuff. And we went out and they said, okay, we done told you guys how to do it. We're going to go out in the yard out front of the school where we were, and we're going to let you take this sextant, and you're going to do some sun lines and all this kind of stuff. And we went through the whole thing, and when we plotted where we were, and when I plotted it, I was somewhere about 100 miles out in Gulf of Mexico. And this was Excelsior, Alabama. That's how far off I was. And almost at least half the class failed. And that's the only course ever repeated in the Air Force pilot training. The half of us had to go back in and get a residual course. We had to go back and listen to those guys talk about that for 2 more 3 hours. But they didn't make us shoot any sun. But after that, you know, can you see somebody flying a single-engine jet sitting there trying to do a sun fix?
Oh, golly. That reminds me of a story.
No autopilot.
Yeah, that reminds me of a story. This old Pan Am captain retired in San Francisco, and he really loved sailing. And he had a little sailboat, I don't know, 30 or 40 footer. And he had no compass or anything like that. And he'd sail all around the area of San Francisco and the Bay Area. And then one time he told the paper, he said, well, I'm gonna sail from San Francisco to Hawaii. And I'm not going to have a compass on my boat. And the person that did the story said, well, aren't you afraid you're going to get lost out in that big Pacific Ocean? And he says, no, I think I can make it. And he said, well, what are you going to use for navigation? Celestial? And he says, no, I don't know anything about the stars. He said, what I'm going to do is I'm going to look up there and look at all those contrails that are going from San Francisco to Hawaii. And that'll get me right there.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Well, I just wanted to mention, Neil, that Chuck had mentioned Ensign Philip Dalton on the improved slide rule. And so I looked him up to see who he was, and he happened to be a Lieutenant Philip Dalton. He was here from April 1903 to July 1941. He was a U.S. military scientist, a pilot, and an engineer. and he's best known for his invention of several slide rule analog flight computers, and the most famous being the E6B, which is something that we've all been talking about recently. And then Jim Holdren mentioned Harold Gaddy, so I wanted to see who he was. And he was an Australian navigator and an aviation pioneer. And Charles Lindbergh actually called Gaddy the Prince of Navigators. So it was very interesting learning about these tonight, not even being in aviation like you folks. So it was excellent. Great show.
Hey, Neil. Neil, Jim, and
yeah,
Jim Holder.
Yeah.
I remember years ago, one of my best friends, a pilot for Eastern, New York, San Juan, Loran, he said there was a dead spot between New York and San Juan using Loran. Is that
it was
true?
All dead to me, Don.
Well, I've never heard that. We did have a captain at Eastern named Sonny Seaman on the 10-11,
yeah,
and I flew New York,
yeah,
San Juan with him, and he was,
yeah,
such a good low-round operator. He had to do a lot of stuff with the knobs and whistles and all that kind of stuff, but he never touched the one of them. He'd just take his hand and go across off them, and he could make that thing sing, boy. And I mean,
yeah,
we were out on course,
yeah,
and we had a TWA one day out there, got confused and lost, and they found us, and they said, well, can you keep Eastern in sight? And TWA followed us all the way to New York City.
Oh, wow.
That's a true story.
You know, when I got my approval for Loran, when I checked out on the 727, and I had that New York check captain that was went down with me to San Juan and came back with me, and it was a Boston trip. That's right, Boston, San Juan. And he had me Loran it down there and Loran it back. And I swear, I just used the heading that the flight plan that Eastern had calculated the winds and everything, and I stayed on that, and by God, I hit San Juan right smack down the middle. But coming back, I think, for Boston, he told me, he said, you know where you're going to wind up? And I said, I hope Boston. He said, no, right now we're looking at Rhode Island, somewhere in Rhode Island. So, I was that far off course, and he said, to hell with it. He said, go ahead. He signed me off. But I didn't get any help from my co-pilot or engineer on that trip. It was really funny.
But I got a real short one, another short story, if you want me to tell it, Neil. I don't want to talk too much.
No, go ahead. These are fun.
All right. You remember Van Rollin, don't you?
Oh,
Van,
yeah.
Van Rollin was chief pilot in Atlanta for that. He was a VP of flight ops, and he was real big on the negotiating committee for the Blue Book. He was chairman of the negotiating committee. And if it wasn't in the book to get paid for it, he didn't want anything to do with it. And we got that Flying Tiger DC-8-63 route from Atlanta to Orlando and Charlotte, then back to Atlanta, and then out to L.A. And the Orlando and Charlotte didn't last very long, but I flew that aircraft, and it had dual INSs. And Eastern did not have INS pay in our contract. And Van Rollin says, okay, I'm not touching that INS. But, of course, we didn't get paid for it. But us co-pilots, by the time we got to the airplane, every one of us knew how to operate an INS, because we'd go to 39,000 feet in that airplane and get clear direct L.A. Didn't have to do anything else, just go direct L.A.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Van Rollin would sit over there, but he said, made it very clear that we weren't getting paid for it. He wasn't going to touch it. But that didn't mean he didn't want to look over and see you touching it. And he'd look over at it, and I'd say, we're right on court, Captain. Here it is. And he'd go back, read the newspaper. Then I'd come back and look at it again. I'd say, yeah, that's it. He could get his pipe out and get it going again. And all the way out to L.A., he'd been back. And I did that with him five or six times. And he'd never touched INS, but he sure as hell used it.
Yeah.
It hooked it up to the autopilot. You didn't have to do anything, you know. That airplane was a wonderful airplane.
Yeah.
I love the DC-8.
Well, Omega on the 10-11 was great navigation equipment. It was a digital readout, and I didn't understand it too fully. I could program it, but that's about it. And But it's we've had some good nav systems, and when I first came on board on the Convair 440, we were using VORs, and that was the standard of navigating and the Victor Airways, as we mentioned tonight in our program. And so we've come a long way, and of course, if you're above 18,000 feet, the Victor Airways turned into J routes, and they were called Jet routes, and J Airways. And then if you're on a Loran chart, you had a different routing structure. If you were out in the ocean, you had an amber, a green, and a blue, and all sorts. I never did fully understand that either. But it was a lot of fun flying airplanes, and some clear nights you could take off out of Atlanta on a beautiful clear night. Going to L.A. at night, you could almost see L.A. from Atlanta. The visibility sometimes on those trips out there were just, it was remarkable how far you could see out. And good program, the guys. It was really good. Linda, I'm going to turn it back over to you.
Okay. Well, we've learned a lot about navigation tonight, and we know we've only scratched the surface. Perhaps another show would be necessary to bring this up to date with the current methods of air navigation. Now, what do you think about that, Mr. Producer, Captain Neal?
Well, I think it would be fun, but I think we probably were at our depth tonight talking, just discussing it. But the printed material really gave a good history of air navigation. And it really, yeah. Back in the old days, you hung around the airports like Orville and Wilbur and Curtis and those guys. They didn't go on too long a trip because their little old airplanes wouldn't make it. But then they started to venture out, and it was an accomplishment when they first crossed the English Channel, which is 20-some miles wide. But we've come a long way, and now we navigate to the moon and back. And looking at Mars in the future. So, wow, man, we have come a long way. Dorothy, what you got for us on the website coming up?
Well, I wanted to mention that today, or this month, is Women's History Month, and it's been all over the internet everywhere talking about the different things that women have done their lifetime, and one of them, of course, was Amelia Earhart, which was all over the internet. And it's strange today, too, that when I opened up my cell phone, there was the picture of the Wright Brothers plane, similar to the one that Don just built, the model. No. So I was amazed to think of the story that was out in the internet, which is quite long. It was a video, which I sent to a couple of people. The fact that we're still talking about that is amazing. But I did want to comment that it's Women's History Month, and people like Carlene and different Beverly Bass and people like that, it's really an honor to know them. So we thank them for all they did. I also want to mention that April 10th to the 15th is Sun and Fun, and information is up on our website to link you to that Sun and Fun website. We have our Thursday program coming up from the Eastern Files. That's coming up episode 51, more notes that Neil is going to be doing on Thursday, followed by next Monday's episode of Eastern Air Shuttle and the Trump Shuttle. So any one of you out there that had a tenure on the shuttle, whether it be Eastern or Trump, please call in or write to us at host@ealradioshow.com and let us know, and we'd love to hear from you. Following that, of course, we're going to have another Hup Harrigan series. It's going to be part 4 of 5, and then after that, we'll have the crew resource management. So we have a lot coming up. I do want to mention, too, that we have 986 members. We're looking to all of our Eastern people to let their friends know that we would love to have them as members and to keep us in mind and go to our website and sign up. It's free membership, and we'd love to have you. Our sponsor, too, is Repo, and we thank them for all that they do. And to remind you that the 2018 Repo Convention in South Carolina is coming up on September 4th to September 7th. And before that, we have the Silver Liners Convention at the Wyndham Grand in Jupiter, and that's May 15th to the 18th. So our Eastern BRAT program is being rescheduled for April 23rd. We had it originally April 16th, but now it's going to be the 23rd, and we'd still like to hear from more of you Eastern people out there that had children, and to please have them write to us at host@ealradioshow.com. Send us in your name and your telephone number so we know we can recognize it when we get on the radio, and we're looking forward to many of you Eastern people joining us. So that's it, Neil, and it's back to you.
Well, I got a great email from a national airline flight attendant that listened to our show last week when the program was, "Honey, look what I brought home from my layover and my trip." And she, and along with other national folks, listened to the program broadcast. And she's really telling all of her fellow flight attendants with National that they ought to go to our archive and listen to that, because most of those stories were by National Airline flight attendants. So I extended her an invitation to see if she could get five or more flight attendants or national people, and we could do a national airline show. I'd love to hear the national. Our competitors won't allow Delta to be on with us, but we'll take national, but brand X. But no, Delta is welcome anytime. But the national folks have got a wonderful Facebook presence, and they have a very, very great community of former employees, just like the Eastern family, the National family. And a lot of history there with National and Eastern competing on a lot of their route structures. And so it would be good to have a show, Dorothy, in the future, if we can get Maria, I think her last name is Bacon or Barron, I forgot, I don't have it in front of me now. But she was one of the ones that talked about what she brought home from layovers. And she really liked the show. She really did. So it was a very good compliment from another carrier. So we are listened to by lots of folks out there. Hmm?
That was Mari Bacon you're talking about.
Yeah, Mari Bacon.
Right.
Yeah.
Very, very, very nice.
Yeah, very nice comment. Yeah, National.
National's commercial. Fly me, I'm Don. Fly me, I'm Linda, or whatever.
Yeah, Carol and all, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. It was really good. I've got one song that I want to play, because Dorothy sent me an email and she's got a video of it. I think it's on the website, Dorothy.
Yes,
but I just want to listen to this right before we sign off, and I want you to listen to this and put your own words there. Just listen to the singer and the thoughts behind the song, and just do your own thinking about our great company, because it's a wonderful song, and it's really appropriate for folks like us that have memories of a great airline.
It's a great video, which is on the website. In fact, you folks should visit our website under videos. We have several there that are great, but that one there, it moved me. And
here it goes, Dorothy.
I'm only Eastern, so...
Thanks for the memory of things I can't forget. Journeys on a jet, our wondrous week in Martinique and Vegas and roulette. How lucky I was. And thanks for the memory of summers by the sea. Dawn in Waikiki, we had a pad in London, but we didn't stop for tea. how cozy it was. Now since our breakup, I wake up alone on a gray morning after. I long for the sound of your laughter, and then I see the laughs on me.
Captain Steve, be sure to tune in again next Monday at 7 p.m. when Eastern Flight 357 will be taxiing from the gate with another adventure. The topic next week is going to be the Eastern Airlines Donald Trump shuttle. Please be sure to be with us. I'm kind of inquisitive. I'd like to know who is a king proposition with Eastern. Maybe it didn't make money fast enough for Mr. Trump. So I'm looking to be with Paul. And that's our show for tonight, folks. And we thank all for participating in tonight's broadcast, and especially our listeners. With this, we take a line from Lake Wobegon Stories, where all the Eastern women are unequal. All the Eastern men are good-looking, and all the Eastern children and Eastern grandchildren are way above average. Until then, we say good night, Eastern family.
Good night, Eastern.
We love you.
Good night, Eastern. We love you.
Good night, you guys. Great show, Neil. Great show.
Good show. Thanks so much.
Yeah, good show.